who had these incredible, this incredible presence on the film and were able to share the story. So I think, we were able to sort of find that. I don't know if it's a balancing, but between that sort of legal, the big legal concepts, but really grounded in that ongoing lived living experience that our leadership brings to these issues. Like, it's not just that they're.
When this film was being thought of and contemplated, I think it was being thought of for quite some time, for many years, as the leadership at the day. There was multiple different councils and hereditary leaders and community members throughout the years who really championed the battle for the Nachako well beyond our court journey in 2011. But I think at that time we were also engaged in other social justice issues and environmental related matters, and had affiliations prior to this legal court journey. As Liana mentioned, beyond the courtrooms and the boardrooms, our nations were collectively aligning on opposition to other developments being proposed in the region around the time we started our journey in the courts against Rio Tinto Alcan for our pursuit to save the Nachako River. So we had that experience as the Inka Dene Alliance, and I think coming into shifting focus to another project that impacted our rivers, looking more closely at home with the Nachako River, we were able to really see this as an opportunity to ensure, narrative sovereignty and our ability to tell the story about our resistance, but also our resiliency as well. We've had, with other opportunities, I guess, that have arisen around our opposition. Some may have taken it upon themselves to defy, I guess, that have arisen around our opposition, but also at that same time, we were trying to ensure our ability to pursue projects that were in alignment with our community's values and our stewardship obligations as Yinka Dene people who have, responsibility and relationship with the land and the waters as well. So, taking this moment through this project, through this film journey, to ensure that our story was being told in a way. And I think Lana did an amazing job, and we had such an amazing, predominantly Indigenous crew, film crew, help us, amplify our story that we wanted to tell. And while it is navigating a very, technical precedent setting case, it also, help advance the film making industry in the process as well. So while we were able to tell our story, we were able to ensure that, other Indigenous communities can ensure that, that sovereignty, that narrative sovereignty piece is considered, but also associated benefits with telling our story.
You touched on again some of these points that I was hoping to address, which I guess I might just kind of very pointedly ask, what effect do you think, or that you know, or that you've heard feedback that you've gotten from members of the Saikuz Nation or Stellarton Nation, if once this documentary was out, what effect or what change did it have for members of those nations?
So one of the other layers that we were able to include in this film was developing an impact campaign. There's multiple major projects being proposed within the region, but also utilizing it as a tool to engage with not only our members of our respective communities of Stellarton and Saikas, but also within the broader non-Indigenous communities as well, the Vanderhoof community, the Fraser Lake, everywhere else, all the way to Kitimat. So it really did help raise, greater awareness about that. But it also allowed for conversations to occur around food sovereignty, impacts to health and well-being and racism, systemic racism, and having those difficult conversations around settler colonialism. So these types of conversations were able to kind of pull from different themes of the film, which you hear brought out by the different characters that are highlighted. And as Liana mentioned, there's just a few folks that are highlighted in this film, but there's multiple generations of community members and leadership who have been raising these issues for many years. And I think it really does offer the opportunity to have those conversations, not just in the courtrooms and the boardrooms, but in the classrooms, in the workspaces, and, you know, out on the land where a lot of these industrial activities are happening at the operational level.
Yeah, we had a screening before the premiere of the film last year in Vanderhoof for community members. And it was it was the most nervous I've been through the whole process, because, you know, this was the audience that I most wanted to be okay with what they were seeing on the screen. And the response was amazing. And there were just two things in particular. One of the community members whose relative they heard through the archival recordings, you know, was so emotional and so moved by being able to hear the voice of their relative. And then I had a family member who was there too, who just spoke to me a number of times, called me actually a couple of days later to talk about how highly he thought of the film and how good it was to see our people on the screen in that way.
Yeah, I think there are, regardless of our geographical situations, we are still connected within these different watershed systems and, you know, the broader climate connections. And I think there's still opportunities for us to collectively, you know, question the systemic racist platforms that are advancing, you know, different processes, different laws and legislation that aren't in alignment with our collective wellness and stewardship obligations that we have, whether we're Indigenous or non-Indigenous. I think there's still the opportunity to ensure that, principles like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, you know, that those are still being considered in amongst the broader Canadian public and whichever watershed system you might be in, because those implications can affect anyone. You know, when projects aren't done in a good way, led by those people who have been stewarding those resources for millennia. So I think, you know, we can continue to question these systems that continue to do harm, and work with Indigenous peoples to identify and advance solutions that we are creating, because I think many of our communities and First Nations communities, we're not always against developments or trying to impede certain things. We just want to ensure that, you know, there's systems that are in place, that they're being done in a good way, that they're in alignment with our values and our principles, and can meet objectives that benefit all of us.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And that's, I mean, very similarly, what I was thinking was one of the main things that I was thinking through the making of this film throughout over the years was how remarkable it is, I think, that the nations are doing this work, you know, for the nations and for their membership, but for the good of all of, you know, the communities and the systems and structures, because we've always had this understanding that our waters are connected, our lands are connected, that what happens in one part of our watershed is going to affect other parts. And so the restoration and the stewardship of that is really crucial for the health and well-being of everyone. I just don't think we can tolerate these really policies that are ruining us anymore, and work together to figure out a good way forward. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so looking forward to watching this documentary in a room full of people, whether they're seeing it for the first time or if they've seen it before here in Smithers. And I just thank you so much both for taking the time out of your extremely busy schedules to speak with me.
Thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Time now for Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio is Pablo Vimas, our gardens expert from Embark Sustainability here on the SFU campus in the Student Union Building. Welcome, Pablo.
Thank you. Thank you, Ach. Nice to be here.
The weather is pretty nice this week.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Finally, over the weekend, the weather warm up and quite bright and sunny. Mm-hmm. And you might notice that we still have quite a sunlight until 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So it's like, yep, the season is here, the season to start gardening.
And you can feel how it's, you know, warmer now when the sun is out than it was, say, 2 weeks ago even. Yeah. You know, that change is coming.
Yes,
it's happening.
It's happening, but as well here in Burnaby Mountain, we have still a wind that is cold. Mm. Wind that still reminds you, like, it's no, we are not yet there the way we want to be out in shorts and t-shirts. But yes, it reminds us still is a cold weather.
Yeah.
So we as a gardeners, these bright lights, long days, just invite us to bring all the crops and all the vegetables to the garden. So today is talking about being cautious. The sun is bright, beautiful days, but just remember that it still is too cold for summer crops.
Mm-hmm.
So at this time of the year, we spend most of the time planting leafy greens, which are vegetables that stand very well this kind of cold temperatures between 10 and 15 degrees.
Right.
And at night, we still have around 6 degrees Celsius. So still a bit cold. And the vegetables like a cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, kohlrabi, they stand this weather. They are all okay. Spinaches as well. And lettuces do well. But hold on a little to your basil. If you have basil plants, just hold it a bit. You have tomato plants that are already in the nurseries. You can see that you can purchase them, but still it's a bit too cold for them to come out. Perhaps people who've been following us during this last year, that we've been transitioning from a shady, cold gardening, winter-protected garden to a more open garden. We have in our garden, we have sunlight from 8:30 in the morning. So it's full sun already. But the wind still is cold. So that's we also learning that in the other garden, we were okay bringing plants because we're still in the shade. Now it's not the case because some plants, which were not used to be a full sun, they are sunburned. You can see the leaves are already suffering. Yeah.
Right. And you talked to, maybe it was last week or the week before, but the need to acclimatize your plants. Don't just sort of take them from your indoor nursery or wherever and take them straight out.
Yes. Yeah. So we talk about the hardening off system that bring your plants slowly to these bright conditions and warm conditions in order to prevent this shock that the plants are having right now. Even plants that are in the nurseries, because they still have undercover, there is no direct sunlight.
Yeah.
So they are... They're not exposed to full sun, and now we are seeing some plants that are really getting their leaves sunburned. But yeah, that is a learning that we are is happening at the moment here in our new site.
Yeah, because you've had some of your gardening cohort get a little too excited, a little too ambitious, and it didn't work out. Tell us about that.
They really came and just tried to put the vegetables as much as possible.
Yeah.
But the one thing is that they just moved directly from the under the grow lights straight to the garden.
Yeah.
Even though our gardens have hoop houses, it still was the shock of the cold.
Yeah.
And now we've seen that they have bring from directly from the grow lights into the full sunlight.
Yeah.
So those are things that, well, we are learning. But again, is this a motivation to start growing and growing food, and just we think that everything is going to be okay because it's just the sun bright in there. So so let's be a bit patient. Let's take our time, and let's start with cool crops that likes this kind of weather, bright but still cold in the evenings. So as we continue planting some seeds of radishes, carrots, spinach. So those are the crops that still, and cilantro. I love cilantro. The garden has to have cilantro.
Yeah.
As well, we will notice that our plants like thyme and oregano just started again coming back from the winter dormancy. So they are also quite good. And finally, our apple trees and pear trees, fruit trees that we transplanted as well, we had to move them. They are well as are budding. So yeah, so the garden is slowly taking shape.
Great.
And don't forget to get your onions as well. Onions, the onion set. So it's little onions that you planted for the summer. So
what are the plants people should be focusing on right now, and what are the ones they should be a little careful about?
So at the moment, we will start with everybody likes asparagus, so you will have crowns of asparagus ready to bring to your garden.
Yeah.
Once you plant asparagus, you have to wait for 2 years before you harvest. So that is asparagus is a perennial, so you plant now, and in 2 years you harvest for first time, and then you can harvest year after year, and it will stay always producing. So this is the moment to start those. Also, we have arugula, beet, mesclun. Mesclun is a mix of lettuces.
Yeah.
So it's a mix of lettuces. Arugula, mizuna, which is a type of... we have mizuna. I forgot them. And then we have a cress, watercress, and herbs like a fennel and dill. And cilantro and parsley. There's a time to put them.
Yeah.
Of course, still time to put some leeks in the ground.
Yeah.
So you can buy small seedlings of leeks. Kohlrabi, as I mentioned. Kale, certainly. Kale is year-round crops.
Yeah.
We just keep planting year-round. Peas, snap peas. That's the time as well to plant our snap peas. Hopefully this year the deer doesn't visit too early, so we can have at least the plant develop.
Yeah.
Radicchio, that is another vegetable that likes to grow year-round. So if you have radicchio, you harvest, it stands in winter very well.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a perennial. Swiss chard, that's tends to disappear over the winter, kind of rottens, so you need to replant over the new spring. If you are into sanchoques, this is the time the sanchoques will be harvesting sanchoques, because they is perennial, they stay all over winter. So this is the time if you want to plant sanchoques, just go ahead. As I mentioned, sanchoques is a perennial crop, so you have to make sure that where to plant always stays there. Even though when you harvest them, still you will miss one or two sanchoques in there, and the next year it comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same when you forget one potato, and now you go and see, oh, all the potatoes are popping up.
Yeah.
So those are the vegetables. And the ones that we should avoid are the vegetables that like warm weather, like I mentioned, tomato, basil, chili peppers, aubergines, or eggplant, and tomatillos. Tomatillos, I think, are still too early to bring them outside.
Right. And so the ones we're putting in now, when are we going to start coming ready for harvest?
Oh, they we should be ready for harvest by mid-May, beginning of June. Yes,
okay.
So very quick. And there's other thing that we need to keep in mind, that because our winter was very mild, we don't know how soon the summer will come as well, because the temperature didn't drop too much. So could be that this year, by mid-May, we might have a good weather for summer weather already.
Right. Do we have to worry anything about, because of the mild winter, about garden pests?
Ooh.
You know, often the winter will take care of them.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Over the winter, usually most of the pests die.
Yeah.
But I think because we didn't have these cold temperatures below 0 degrees Celsius. So at the moment, we already see aphids. We've been working the soil, and we came across lots of cutworms, which is the larvae of a moth. So we expect to have some problems with pests this year.
Yeah.
And just we need to be ready to squish. If you see there, the aphids are in the leaves, underneath the leaves, just squish them. If they are little ones, a small amount.
Yeah.
But when there is too much, just try to use soapy water. to wash the leaves, and hopefully that helps and reduces. Yeah. And if the plant gets overwhelmed with aphids, there is no solution. Just to snip the plant and dispose. Don't put in your composter. Just dispose for the city can take that.
Yeah.
Don't put in the composter because, again, the aphids will lay eggs and stay there. And next time you bring that compost to your garden, you are just bringing again all the aphids with you. And the pests.
Excellent. What are you going to be looking for in the next week with your gardens here?
In our next week is... We are at the moment we are finishing planting, and so next week we are trying to see to grow potatoes in tubs, because with a summer spring cohort we just finished last week. We had a weather just for transplant because it was cold, misty, high humidity. This today is nice, dry, so we focus on planting seeds. No, next week we are going to focus on planting bulbs or tubers, so planting potatoes and tubs.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. He's with us here every week to talk about what you need to be thinking about and doing with your garden. Thank you so much for coming in today. Tell us a bit about Embark and how people can find out more about it.
Yeah, so it was a pleasure to be here. Embark is a nonprofit organization based here in SFU Bonavie campus. We are in the student union in the ground floor. You can see our work in food justice and climate equity in our website at embarksustainability.org, or follow our work that we do in campus through our social media at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability.
I will see you next week. Thank you.
See you next week. And Pablo will be back next week with more gardening tips. Stay tuned right here on CJSF for Democracy Now, coming up in about 8 minutes. I'm sure they'll be telling us a lot about what happened over the weekend in the war in the Middle East and what's going on there. So tune in for that to get some insight into what's going on there. Lots more great programming coming up on CJSF throughout the day, including Wandering Rhythms up at 12 noon right after Democracy Now. Typically Tuesday up at 3 p.m. and new program Wire and Nerve, which is up at 6 o'clock. So stay tuned, or maybe it's 8 o'clock. I better check the schedule. Anyway, Peter R.H. is here to talk about...
Well,
spies,
the first thing I'm going to say...
Spies and art.
It's not about really spies. It's a bit more boring than that. Anyway, but very quickly, this gondola is a pipe dream. I'll just say that for now. I got reasons why it's a bad idea. It fortunately will never come to being. It'll be the moon for the misbegotten for all those students forever.
But I can't wait till they make it. I think they got to do a lot more about good transit here in the whole Vancouver region, including a reasonably fast and frequent train, at least as far as Chilliwack, if not Hope.
Okay, well, okay. The nonsense minute is over. Okay. So I went to Mercurial Art in Time of Subversion, and this was of the World Literature Student Conference at SFU. So, and then somebody, there was a number of people gave a talk. And this one person, Jacob Chen, Andy Warhol, and consumerism. Now, interestingly enough, SFU does not have an art history course. Lungera does, and he was at Lungera. He took art history there. And I was hoping maybe, because I had the what I call the audio bag, but I didn't really want to have a talk or whatever. He was pretty good. He gave a good talk. And also he was pretty good on my questions. I said that I believe that the thing probably have with Andy Warhol is that he was part of the consumerism. He was making his art go up in value and so on. And he was sort of part of consumerism. And then I brought up the fact that he hated abstract expressionism. And I brought up
Andy Warhol did? Or the speaker.
Andy Warhol hated abstract expressionism. Then I brought up the fact that it's been come about that the CIA started abstract expressionism. Now, interestingly enough, he didn't give me any fight back on this, because this is getting people are agreeing to this. And Stephen, do you agree with this?
I will say I'm going to that when you just throw it out there like that, yeah. Having heard nothing, yeah. Not really heard. I mean,
it's actually well done.
On the surface of it, without knowing about it, sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory. But apparently, there's
it's not a conspiracy theory. If it's documented on like a CIA website and publicly accessible. It's like MK Ultra.
It sounds like the kind of thing that
It's like MK Ultra. Like it's a documented MK Ultra was a documented program for to use LSD and other stuff to get certain performance enhancements or modifications from test subjects that was initiated by the CIA. This is actually much more innocuous. CIA providing funding for certain literary magazines, artistic magazines that instigated the start of abstract expressionism, especially Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock was very much a figure, remember, of the tri-state area, of very specifically Long Island, which at the time contained artists' havens to a much greater extent. Still does, actually. But
Anyway, so, yeah, Stephen kind of filled us in on this. Now then, this was 1990, the controversy over The Voice of Fire, 1.7 million for Three Stripes. Now, which is part of abstract expressionism, by the way. The other thing is that the whole surrealist movement was actually Marxist.
Surrealism and abstract expressionism are actually quite distinct.
Yes, they are, Stephen. That's my point.
They're like kind of parallel trends.
But I'm saying that they're Marxist. In fact, Salvador Dali was expelled from the surrealist movement.
I would actually argue that surrealism is anti-Marxist.
Not according to Andrew Baton, who said that Dali couldn't be a surrealist anymore. Stephen, for all practical purposes, Salvador Dali is a surrealist, but for an infinite number basically impractical reasons, he basically is not.
But Salvador Dali was not a Marxist.
That's why they said you can't be part of our movement anymore.
That's why he got kicked out.
Yeah, but I think that's absurd because Salvador Dali.
Of course, it's absurd. It's stupid.
Because Salvador Dali is the most representative. You could argue the most outstanding artist of the
It was stupidity against stupidity, the abstract expressionism versus Marxist surrealism.
I don't think Marxism has a huge role to play in that regard, in a sense. Yeah, to be like abstract expressionism was, yes, initiated.
Okay, I got something to say. There was a past. He's dead now. Joseph Kyle was actually a good abstract expressionist. His son is trying to... It's not going to be just his father's paintings. A Saturday at 1 to 5, there's an opening at the Paul Kyle Gallery, and that's at 258 East 1st, Unit 4. You go up a floor. So that's 258 East 1st. So you're in Main and 22nd to Minatory. Go one northeast, and then you go east. 25 East 1st. And
that's an exhibition coming up?
Yes, it's of the Paul Kyle Gallery. And Paul is the son of Joseph Kyle, a Canadian, Vancouver-based abstract expressionist that did not involve himself with the CIA. Anyway, I finally got a lot of stuff in. Stephen, you want to say something else?
I don't know. I didn't really catch the first part of it. I mean... There was some strain of, you could argue, anti-Marxism, anti-communism in terms of the initiation of abstract expressionism. But I think the bigger thing was that the people who peopled the CIA at the time, immediately post-war, who came out of the OSS, the Office for Strategic Services, or whatever it is, they were kind of
cultural elites who themselves had an inclination toward novel and avant-garde forms of art, like especially abstract expressionism. I think they sponsored Jackson Pollock through the ages of the CIA and other organizations, affiliate organizations. Not necessarily just for political reasons, but like Jackson Pollock.
Okay, well, we're running out of time. I actually think we should come back to this topic. We obviously
absolutely. It's art is passion.
8 minutes is clearly not enough to dig into this. But we're out of time for today. Thank you to Peter and Stephen. My name is Magnus. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right about now. Excellent. Or maybe in a few seconds.